You're listening to Pod for Ham, a podcast from The Incomparable that's all about the musical Hamilton, taking it one track at a time through the original Broadway cast recording. Every episode features different groups of interesting people talking about a single track. Visit us on the web at pod4ham.com or follow us on Twitter at pod4ham.
My dearest Angelica, tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day. I trust you'll understand the reference to another Scottish tragedy without my having to name the play. They think me Macbeth, ambition is my folly, I'm a polymath, a pain in the ass, a massive pain. Madison is Banquo, Jefferson's Macduff, and Burnham Wood is Congress on its way to Dunsinane.
Welcome back to Pod for Ham, I'm Jason Snell.
Hi, I'm R.A. Conwade.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Showalter.
I'm Orlean Ateev.
All right, we're here to talk about Take a Break. We're not taking a break. We're going hard at work to talk about this song because it's many songs. I think before we started, somebody said it's like five songs in one. There's so much that happens in this. We're really kicking off some of the serious dramatic moments that take us through the second act and all the way to the end of the show. At its core, this song is, I think, really catchy. The take a break lines that are sung by Angelica and Eliza. I think it's a really sweet, catchy tune. But this is also the song that precedes Say No to This. So underlying it, if you know what's coming, underlying it all, it's like this is the last opportunity for Hamilton to do it right. And he fails.
It's the song that I end and stop listening to when I want to have a nice day. Yeah. I stop right after this song.
Yeah. Yes. It goes off a cliff in after this. It's hard. So, you know, the second act is a lot harder than the first act. I guess that's true of life in general. I tell people sometimes, like, I love the movie Lawrence of Arabia, but the first half of it is this rousing adventure story, and then after the intermission, you come back, and it's kind of depressing, but, like, that's life. That's what happens, is you have your great triumph, and then you got to live the rest of your life, and here, Hamilton's about to make some terrible mistakes after turning down this offer to go on a summer vacation, which he probably should have agreed to, I suppose. Let's take these different sections of the, at least subjects of this song in turn. I'm interested what all of you think about them. One thing that we've got going here is we bring back the counting in French with Angelica and Philip. And we see how Philip is growing up, and Philip has his own little rap that he does for Alexander, and it's sweet on the one hand, but I feel like on the other hand, it's also his son is growing up, and is he around or not? I think is the implication here too. What do y'all think about this part of it?
I find it just so creepy once you know what's going to happen, because it's the same melody that you have in Ten Dual Commandments.
Yeah.
Or not, maybe melody isn't the right word. I'm not a really good musical student. But it's the same sound as you have in Ten Dual Commandments. So having Philip sing 1, 2, 3, he's getting ready for what is going to be
for his fate.
Yeah, it's a foreshadowing of his fate in a sort of downhill from here kind of way.
And it has that serious dissonance at the end on 9, like that's strange and not sweet at all. That really does seem to kind of throw that little creepy line in at the end.
Yeah, you're right. It's not just, I mean, it's the, what the song is giving us is this sweet, you know, it's a child counting and learning French and counting in French. But in reality, this is the Ten Dual Commandments music, and we know, maybe not the first time through, but as seasoned listeners, we know that this is also Philip's fate that's happening right in front of our eyes here.
There's something a little interesting in the dynamic between Eliza and Philip just at the top there, where, you know, he's changing what she's singing and he's changing what she's singing, and isn't that kind of Eliza's story with all these guys around her, including his father? Gosh, won't they listen?
That's really interesting.
Well, he kind of freestyles, which is right. how you prove your mettle in this world. And so he takes, you know, he takes the prompt from his mother, and then he changes the line, as they say later on.
It's the something that we mentioned, I think, in some of the episodes in the first act about how we see the progression of characters by the sophistication of their rhymes as well. And so Philip's got his little, you know, his little 9-year-old baby rhyme that he does here. And it's precocious, but I think I really like the thought that this is also showing that he's in the game, right? Like this kid, he's going to be doing like his father. And that's not necessarily the best thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, he rhymes sank and bank, which is a pretty good rhyme for a 9-year-old to do.
Mm-hmm. It's better than poet show it. Certainly.
Yeah, well,
it gets better. That's true.
I think also it just in terms of that, what you're seeing here, I hadn't thought about the Eliza side of it, but what I always gets me is that you're seeing the same actor who's going to die in the Ten Dual Commandments playing the child. So you can't avoid the fact that the future is coming. So that the fact that he is so precocious, that's in some ways what gets him into trouble, because he's precociously getting into a duel and defending his father and wanting to be that guy on the front lines like his father. And we're seeing it from very, very young.
And the double casting, you know, kind of, you know, is another tip off of what's going to happen. I mean, we have Lawrence is the only character in the first act who dies young. And then the actor reappears playing a child and, you know, singing the song, it's you know, it's not going to go well for little Philip.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, oh, act two. Oh, act two, you're going to do it to us, aren't you? You can tell already. any of you particularly into Shakespeare? Because one of the other elements that's here is Macbeth. There's so much Macbeth in this. What do you fans of Shakespeare think about the whole Hamilton is just drawing direct comparisons between his life and Macbeth, and then Angelica? No, Angelica throws it back at him later on too. So what do you think about the Macbeth stuff in here?
I think that there's a ton of Shakespeare in almost every song of this play. I think there's a lot of Hamlet in Hamilton. I think there's Lear.
Yay, Hamlet!
Exactly, yeah. I think that was a real tip-off. But I think Hamlet comes in later. But yeah, I mean, Hamilton has Scottish roots. Ambition right. is certainly his folly. And, you know, the fact that Angelica comes in with the line that Lady Macbeth says in the play is another shading to what's really happening between those characters.
Yeah, that screw your courage to the sticking place coming up at the end of the song is pretty interesting. I think the first section with My Dearest Angelica, it's so clever. You know, the lyrics in that section reinterpreting from the Shakespeare to Hamilton to his view, another Scottish tragedy. There's a lot of doubling and cleverness in the lyrics right there. I get back to, I'm a polymath, a pain in the ass, a massive pain. And I'm like, oh, you are a little bit self-aware. Okay, that's useful. You're not going to do anything about it, buddy. But at least you're a little bit self-aware that things might not be going as well. Hamilton might be a little aware that things are not going as well as they could be, or that they have the potential to do that.
I'm a little torn about whether it's him, you know, saying, oh, woe is me. I've got them conspiring against me, and they think that I'm Macbeth, and isn't this terrible? And whether that's like it's actually like that, or whether he just feels, the character feels, that he's been placed in this role. But I feel like another Scottish tragedy to me feels completely honest, which is that he kind of views himself in that role. It goes back to his fatalism in Act One, where he's sort of just expecting to die, and he just wants to die in battle, and so that he can have some honor. And here he's sort of saying, you know, yeah. Yeah, I am another Scottish tragedy. I believe that. I think that's an interesting little bit of his Hamilton's attitude toward himself. As much as he talks a good game, he seems to always feel like there's a disaster right around the corner.
Right, and that it's inevitable.
So here's a devil's advocate pitch for the optimism view on the other side of it, which is that the Scottish tragedy, I mean, and a lot of Shakespearean tragedies have so much to do with the tragedy of the parents, the tragedy of the wife. I mean, in some ways, he doesn't have a wife who's manipulating situations behind the scenes. He doesn't have some sort of He doesn't have the ghost of his father or his uncle haunting him. Those family dynamics aren't there. He's free to be his own man. Mm. He's free to be a new man. So by comparing himself to Macbeth, maybe it's a hopeful take that he could escape the tragedy of Macbeth. He's parallel to him, but he has this freedom that Macbeth doesn't have to build something new.
Or maybe he's just, pointing out also another section there that they think me Macbeth. I don't think that I am. This is how I'm being painted. Maybe he's just kind of complaining.
Yeah, that's the woe is me part of it, I think. Right.
Oh, my enemies. His attitude might be different.
I'm not sure I believe that he is fundamentally optimistic in that way, but it was a pitch.
Sure.
Well, Macbeth is the character from the Four Big Tragedies who has his fate foretold to him.
Yes.
And he's also the character who, rises the highest and then is eventually, spoiler alert, is eventually captured by someone who was once a friend. So,
for rising above himself.
Well, exactly. He says, and Macbeth is, the legacy question works into Macbeth as well, because Macbeth is told that he will not be the father to kings. Banquo will. So I think I can't decide whether Hamilton is more Hamlet or Macbeth, but it's close on both sides.
Well, and the fact is, Madison and Jefferson have a political future, and Hamilton's about to, tragically, one could argue, squander it away. He's got his fatal mistake. And they are the ones who will be the kings or presidents, right? And he won't be. So in that way, it totally lines up. It's a pretty good parallel, even though, I don't know, it's very meta, right? We're like, is the show commenting on the outcome of the show, or is the character who doesn't, there's so much in Hamilton that it's like, are the characters aware of their fates or not? Because, it's all being told through Burr, who is aware.
Right.
And so that's always the question is this Hamilton we see aware of his fate and commenting on it? Or is he blithely unaware and either optimistic or pessimistic, but he doesn't really know? And there's no answer to that, I think. That's one of the interesting things about the way the story of Hamilton is told.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's so many layers of doubling as the audience who comes in before Burr is even on stage being aware of how it ends. And then you're told how it ends, but then you're also told at the very end that in some ways what Hamilton has built has a longer effect. It lasts longer. His financial system outlives. So there's a way in which he doesn't disappear from history.
Right. He doesn't get the life, but he does get the legacy.
Right.
That's a much pithier way of putting it.
Nicely said.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the themes of this story is Hamilton. Fundamentally, this is the point where Hamilton is explicitly told. We've gotten it before a little bit, but here it is once again. Come with your family. And choose work and your career over your family. And we get that here. Angelica is saying, or Eliza is saying, come away. And then Angelica's coming back and she will say the same thing. You get it with the implication of like, oh, your son's birthday is today. Did you know that? And and he has something that he wants to show you. Please connect with your family. And from Hamilton's part, he's taking funny shots at John Adams. He doesn't have a real job. He's the vice president. He has nothing to do. And
this starts the running gag of insulting John Adams.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Every time Adams is mentioned is a diss.
Comedy gold in musical land.
It's so funny. I picture Paul Giamatti standing off stage looking sad every time.
I do wonder if there's something to that, because the Chernow biography resurrected Hamilton's legacy in the same way that the McCullough biography of Adams resurrected his legacy, and it's kind of like, who is the real forgotten founding father, Hamilton or Adams? And I think Miranda firmly sides with Hamilton, so he has to diss John Adams.
Hey, John Adams got a musical first.
I was going to say, and there are so many 1776 references throughout this show.
Oh, yes. Sit down, John.
Sit down, John.
But so you get the shots in about that, and we also get the callback to Cabinet Battle Number 1. I got to get my plan through Congress. We know, and the notes play from Cabinet Battle Number 1. We know that he's got reasons, right? He's got reasons that he's turning his back on his family and staying in the city to do this job. But at the same time, this is, for me, I mean, this is the moment, right? Because in the next song, it's Say No to This. This is the moment where he gets to choose. And he, once again, maybe for a final time, and he chooses wrong again, or at least he doesn't choose his family, whether that's right or wrong. So what is this song saying about the trajectory of Hamilton in his relationship with his family? I think it's kind of bleak.
Well, you know, I was thinking that this song is really kind of the other side of the coin to, I'm blanking on the name, the finale to the first act. Nonstop, because
yeah.
That's such a rousing number, and we all love it, and it's brilliant. But we kind of see what is Nonstop. How does that really play out in real life?
Right,
it means he doesn't even know it's his son's birthday,
mm-hmm.
and if you're Nonstop, you can't take a vacation. And so this is really the dark right. side of what it's like when someone goes Nonstop all the time. They're kind of, you know. You can't be a good father if you're going nonstop with your job.
And the fact is, you don't get as much done as well anyway. Like, anyone you're working that hard, means you're not thinking particularly straight.
Right.
And we definitely see the consequences of that action.
Oh, he'd
have been a lot better off taking a break.
He would have.
But he doesn't
listen
to people.
He doesn't listen.
I think that's a great point that this isn't just him turning his back. He's making a bad decision in doing this, not just because of what comes, but because could he have been a more effective person? I guess you could ask that about his whole life if he had been a little less extreme and been able to take a break here and there instead of being completely obsessed with his legacy and his and shut everything else out. That's a great point.
It is a great point, but I think there's an argument almost being made here that throughout the show that if he didn't act like he was running out of time, he wouldn't have had a legacy.
Yeah.
So there's a built-in tragedy. There's no way that he would have, if he hadn't worked like that, he wouldn't have left that legacy. But in working like that, he created that doom, essentially.
As somebody who has worked, I mean, I've worked in the and around the technology industry for a long time, I'll tell you, there is definitely an attitude in that industry about, you know, you what you do is you work at the exclusion of anything else for a certain amount of time, and then I guess you cash out and take your money, and then you retire at 40 or something like that. But I see some of that in the approach that Hamilton's taking here, which is I have to do this. This is all I can do, and I'm going to let the rest of my life be a shambles. And it's an interesting choice that I think every person in this who's in a position like Hamilton has to make, which is I have the chance to have a legacy if I throw everything else away, and this is all I do to the exclusion of all else. And you have to choose as a human being, like, do you want to live like that? Do you want to turn? I mean, the take a break, right? It is so pleasant. This whole, there's a lake I know, right? The picture that's painted here is so beautiful, and the song is catchy, and it's so enticing, right? And for him to turn his back on that, you know, that's a big step. He's closing off that whole, you know, opportunity to be a more well-rounded person. And that is the tragedy, I suppose, that this is his legacy. He gets his legacy, but he doesn't get to have anything that window closes, and he never gets to go back to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, how did he get to write the other 51 Federalist Papers? It wasn't because he was having, you know, dinner with his wife every night, I assume. You know, why do we know who he is today? Like, it was because he was this type of person. So that was the trade-off he made.
It reminds me in a lot of ways of the West Wing scene that we have in season one, where Leo McGarry, the John Spencer character, is late for his anniversary and shows up very, very late, forgets this important thing, has to be reminded. And then she says, you need to choose. And, you know, and he says, right now, I can't. Right now, I have to do this because this is the moment and I have to take it and I can make a difference, and lets her walk away.
Mm.
And that's the choice.
It is. It is.
But it's so hard. They're so beguiling. They're so beseeching. You know, and the two of them, those harmonies between Angelica and Eliza are just
Let's talk about it. This is the other big part of this, is that it is Angelica and Eliza. We get a little replay of the Schuyler sisters for a moment there. They sing separately, then they sing together in that final moment of like, you've got to come with us. I have in my notes here, dare I mention the weird dynamic, which is it's his wife and his wife's sister, who earlier has another thing that's in this song. Oh my God, there's so much in here, is that whole, my dearest Angelica, where did you put the comma? So it's on the front burner. Like, what is the connection between Alexander and Angelica? Is that still going on, where there's this like long distance, if things were different, we would be the ones who were together. And then it culminates in the two sisters together saying, come with us, we'll be together. I mean, it is
safe.
Yeah.
Well, and also that lovely bit from earlier, where, which comes from a real letter, that I'm just saying, if you really loved me, you would share him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And there is apparently there's also in a real correspondence. It's actually, I think, Hamilton who makes the joke, but it's the misplaced comma joke is something that actually did happen in his correspondence with Angelica. So but I don't know. I get that moment. It sort of gives me the chills every time, because it is not just go have a nice, wholesome vacation with your wife and child. It's sort of like these two women in his life, both kind of beseeching him to run off with them together, and their sisters, and they're singing it together, and it's kind of weird.
Whatever it takes, you know, whatever it takes to pull you away from your desk, man.
Not even that.
Maybe we're actually assuming that if he hadn't stayed and been involved with his work, then the next song wouldn't have happened. But maybe if he'd gone to the lake, he still would have been seduced and made a bad decision. Maybe this is just sort of like, you know what? There's no good decisions here. He's just always going to make a bad decision when women come.
We're back to Macbeth, too, which is, this is the element of any tragedy, which is that he can't make a good decision. Like, the math doesn't work. He is going to make a choice where he's going to lose his legacy, or he's going to lose his family. I mean, it's never going to end well for Hamilton. You can see it at this point.
And it's kind of the brilliance of what Lin-Manuel Miranda has done here, because what is the one thing you know about Alexander Hamilton? It's that he dies in a duel with Aaron Burr. Like, that's the one thing you know. So you know going in that the main character that you're supposed to be exploring their story, there's no unknown about how this is going to end.
Yeah.
But you still hope. I think there's something. I went to go see Hadestown last week, and it's Orpheus and it's Eurydice, and it's spectacular. But it's also one of these, you know how the story ends, but every time you still hope it'll come out different. You still hope that Hamilton will make a better decision, or that Burr won't shoot, or that Orpheus won't turn around, and or that, you know, Romeo will get the timing right. Right. And it never comes out right, but you still hear people gasp in the audience.
There's a this is a totally random, but the first time they did instant replay in sports on television, they actually had to explain that the same team didn't score a second time. And there's actually a scene in a movie, a Steven Soderbergh movie, where a guy has a tape of his team losing the Super Bowl, and he says every time he gets to the end, he hopes it'll come out different, but it never does. And it's that feeling of like eternal hope, but always, it's always going to be futile. You know, Lucy is always going to pull the football away from Charlie Brown. It is just, it's always going to be that way. It's so sad, but that's, you know, that's a form of a tragedy, is always that. And I always think, oh, Alexander, the ladies, they want you to come with them to the lake. Go, Alexander, go. It's such a beautiful song. He never does.
For me, when I first heard the opening of this song, it reminded me not as much of the Ten Dual Commandments, but of Les Miserables, that the beginning of One Day More, where you have that the sort of the sound of the notes going down, that it's right at the beginning of the song. And One Day More is the, you know, the end of Act One of Les Miserables. And Nonstop is very much like that end of Act One in Les Miserables, where you don't know what's going to happen, and some of these people are going to live, and some of these people are going to die. But there's something very structurally weird about how this song is placed, in a way, because you have that end of Act One number, that it's nonstop, and it's not as uncertain But in some ways, this is more of the pivot point, mm-hmm. because when you open Act Two, you've got this really upbeat song, and then you have a really intense song, but one that Hamilton kicks ass in. And this is the turning point, like two songs in. I don't know. Does that strike anyone else as being a little structurally unusual?
I think there's something interesting where the first act, you know, everything is concerned about Alexander Hamilton and his path, but the first act is very much also concerned with the kind of arc of the revolution and politics. But then the second act, you know, we get so deep into the family stuff that by the time we get to the election of 1800, you actually get the line, "Can we get back to politics, please?" You know, it pulls so deep down into this dramatic personal world where it touches upon the political in the second act that I think that pivot point comes where it does here and almost becomes a lot more important than the political stuff. It kind of happens around it. So suddenly where we didn't get a lot of personal drama having the gravity besides, say, like that would be enough, in the second act it's a lot of deep, you know, deep gravity personal drama.
I'm just realizing this now, but this song also, I mean, it sets up the personal disaster because he has the affair, but it also sets up his political downfall, which is intertwined because he does win the battle. The first bank of the United States or whatever is formed, but that makes Jefferson hate him even more. And then Jefferson is one of the conspirators who finds out about the payments. So he has his one of his triumphs, and we live under the world that he created with a Federal Reserve. But, you know, don't piss off Jefferson.
His personal is completely political, and it has been kind of the entire way through.
I feel like the beginning of this, Act Two is packed in a way where I can't see, they would need to insert more numbers for it not to run in the order it does, because they all follow one another, right? Jefferson has to come back. Then there's the meeting of a cabinet. This comes immediately after the cabinet meeting because it's the reason he stays. And then we get Say No to This. So I don't know. In Act One, there are a few points where you could kind of reorder the songs and it would probably not make a whole lot of difference. But here, we've got a whole sequence of events that happens, and it has to happen in this order. I sort of feel like, shouldn't there be something between Take a Break and Say No to This? Because I kind of feel like I want to see the work progressing and then him getting tempted. And instead, it's like literally come away with this. No, instead, I'm going to go over here. It's like so sudden. And I guess that's a could be effective in the whiplash of it. But it does seem sort of like just a little sudden to me that it happens immediately.
There's something that's interesting that happens in the theater for it, where the first act, and I noticed this after I had seen it, in the first act you're getting like, there's a lot of songs with buttons at the end and everyone applauds. And there's a song and everyone applauds, and there's a song and everyone applauds, and it's very musically. The sort of momentum of the second act, however, means that there is less and less and less applause after the numbers as it gets deeper into this drama, and it just catapults you forward. And I think it's very effective that way. So, you know, there isn't really a space to breathe between Dear Theodosia and the end of the show, almost.
Yeah,
now, there's an intermission in there, but
no breathing during the intermission.
No, because you're, you know, on the line for the bathroom the whole time. But it really does catapult forward.
It does catapult forward, and it is really emotional. And it may be simply that I'm a contrarian in a way, but I find this song to be very emotionally manipulative in a way that I resist. And I was reading the Hamiltome, and there's a footnote where it says that a musical theater composer I love and admire came to a workshop and said, "Take out Take a Break." And Lynn decided to keep it in, which I always wonder if that was Sondheim, because I know Sondheim gave him notes. But I kind of wish they had that he had taken it out, because I feel that the forward momentum of everything else feels like it moves on its own. And here, those five things that are happening at the same time that you referenced, Jason, in the beginning, it's almost too much. And all of it is very much, I'm tearing on your heartstrings. I'm going to ask you to make this decision. Angelica is only here for the summer. And the little kid is singing a song, only it's not a little kid, it's an adult, and he's going to die. And, you know, it's just, I feel like I'm watching an ABC or Lifetime movie for a moment. And I realize that's an unpopular opinion.
Take a break for the Alexander Hamilton story.
But I kind of, there. I wonder what it would be like. So sometimes I just skip the song. Because I really, I don't enjoy it as much as the other ones. But
you're so diplomatic.
I don't know. Is the emotional manipulation, am I alone on that? Does anyone else kind of?
Totally alone.
Oh,
no,
you're right.
I mean, it's the kid on top of the Schuyler sisters, on top of the kind of sinister notes at the end of it. Yeah, I don't think you're wrong that there's something a little bit emotionally manipulative about it. I don't mind all of it. I like some parts of it more than the others.
I'll stick up for it because it somehow in like 4 minutes or so packs about 3 or 4 different plot lines that pay off later in the show. And it's a little emotionally manipulative, but I mean, to do all that in 4 minutes, I'll give it a pass.
I don't object to it.
Oh, it's not. I mean, we're not, I was using hyperbole. I'm not going to actually throw it away. You know, I'm not actually going to say that there's something in Hamilton that I hate.
I'm going to kind of join with you in the way that you phrase that. I would say I like this song because I think it's a very pleasant song, but I think it's absolutely manipulative. In some ways, you could really argue this is setting up Say No to This. We need to see how far Alexander has kind of rejected his look at your look at your son. Isn't he great? Look at it's Angelica and Eliza. They're beseeching you. You're turning their back on them. Like, you got to make people really see what he's doing in Say No to This. And you could make the argument, as pleasant as a song as this is, that I think, to the mystery composer's point, it's not necessary in any way, because although it's got a lot of stuff in it, it's really just pushing forward existing threads, and it doesn't resolve any of them. It gets us to see Angelica and Eliza a little bit more, which means that when they come back later on, it hasn't been forever since we've seen them, and it gets to set up Philip, and so that it's not the next time we see him before he has his duel isn't the first time. We get to set that up a little bit. It's got the, you know, it's taking forward the threat of Cabinet Battle Number One and why he's working on this. It gets a John Adams joke in. Yay, that's great. And has fun with Macbeth. But I mean, is it necessary to the story? It's so pleasant, but it's not necessary at all. It really is just sort of, I get the job. I feel like it does some things that it's helpful that it exists there, and it's a pleasant song, but I could totally see that it's not required in that way. I think that's a really interesting point.
There's a way, I think, that you could say that if the composer here trusted his audience, if the storyteller trusted his audience a little bit more, and whether or not he should, that's another question, because a lot of people need to be reminded who everybody is over and over again in order to track a narrative, myself included, very often. But all of these things are things that are kind of like making sure Philip is introduced again. It's because you're worried that people won't be keeping up with you, that they aren't going to be able to move as fast as you do. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to go way more out on the limb here and get really pilloried and say it's a little condescending.
I think it's a little more like a previously on the West Wing. Like, in case we were wondering where we were here. And I guess it's useful in that sense because there is so much time that seems to have passed. I'm not sure there's a more effective way of doing it. It's a plotty. Not plotting. It moves ahead quickly. It is a plotty song.
Remember his family? He's about to ruin that, so you need to be reminded. Right. Remember the sisters? They were great.
It's
you're going to feel bad for them.
Well, it's why I would close my eyes at the start of the Battlestar Galactica credits when they would flash forward and show you everything that was going to happen and you didn't want to know.
Although they did it very stylishly, and that's actually that this is very stylish. Mm-hmm. He's doing it very stylishly, but it is a bit of the exposition fairy has come down.
Well, there's just so much life here that he has to jam in. And I mean, if this were a fictional character, I think you would maybe say, well, you know, just cut this affair plot line. It kind of comes out of nowhere, and do you really need it? You can figure out some other way. But he did have the affair, and it was the first political sex scandal in the nation's history. So you need to have it in there somewhere, and you need a little bit of setup so that we see what he's throwing away by having this, you know, stupid affair.
Well, do you really, though? Because Eliza and Angelica are introduced so dramatically in Act One and so unforgettably that, I mean, how are you ever going to forget how smart Angelica is and how much in love Eliza is? And then
it's the only place you get their correspondence, though. You know, it's the only spot you really get besides that.
He stuffed everything in here that he couldn't fit elsewhere that he really wanted.
It really does feel that way, doesn't it?
You know, it's got the comma sex and everything. Like,
there is something, though, that like in melodically that the duet or the harmonies that Angelica and Eliza are singing, that does kind of lead into the kind of music and sound you have in Say No to This that's sultrier rather than rappier.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So it you know, it's almost like they get them all turned on and then they leave. And so
what's he left to do?
Yeah, it's summer in the city, man.
Mm-hmm.
Someone under stress meets someone looking pretty.
So we've spent almost 45 minutes talking about a song that we're not sure is actually necessary, but it sure is interesting. And next time on Pod for Ham, yes, indeed, Say No to This, avert your eyes, open your ears, perhaps. But until then, this is that wraps up this edition of Pod for Ham. I'm Jason Snell, and thank you to my guests, Kathleen Showalter, Orlean Ateev, and Aryeh Cohen-Wade. We'll see you next week.
Congress. I can't stop till I get this plan through Congress.